accession number 20937, reel 12.
Howell Reel 12.
Yes, rations were not in great supply, but wandering around in this little hamlet, as I'd rather describe it, only a few houses, were two sheep and one pig. And I had my eye on them, and after the first few days up in this position, by the way, this would be the, I suppose, the back, between the, I don't know, the back end of September, December now, I would think. And I knew how to deal with the sheep as regards killing and preparing for cooking, so there was no problem. I got one of these sheep and I killed it and disemboweled it, skinned it, and did that while we were out in position. The gun barrel proved a nice place to hang it up on, which I did. And that when we went back to our old farmhouse, that when it got dark, I divided it up, kept what we wanted from the carcass, and sent the rest back to troop headquarters for distribution to the rest of the troop. Very nice it was too. And a couple of days or so later, I did the same with the other sheep. And we used to we had a little hole in the ground where we used to sit during the day and try to get a bit of warmth and sit there smoking. And on this one day, I'd killed the other sheep, and it was hung up on the, its remains were hung on the gun barrel again, and the airborne commander, a large, very large man, on this morning came stalking across together with some of his aides because of the smoke that was going up, ordered me, asked who was the commander. It wasn't obvious from the way we were dressed it was the commander, and ordered us to put the fire out and said if we want to keep warm, he'd give us a job to do, helping his infantrymen to dig trenches and that type of thing. So I said, no need, sir, we've kept ourselves warm, and pointed towards the gun barrel where the sheep was dangling. He nearly turned a somersault, asked where our commander was. I directed him to the troop commander's place. And the next thing I got was a message from back from the troop commander. No more killing, and make sure I get my share. That was the message that came back from the troop commander, old Ginger Woods. And so, yes, the pig was spared. He would have been the next one on the list. One evening, when we were back at the, in the old farmhouse, it would probably have been about 8 o'clock in the evening, my chap, member of the crew who was on guard outside, and usually the guard was done, he stood up in the turret of the M10, where it was a bit higher and protected if necessary. He came to the doorway of the old farmhouse, whispered, "Sarge, Sarge, there's somebody coming in the wood. It sounds like girls." And of course, it was pitch dark out there. So I said, "Okay, go back to the M10, and when they get near enough, halt them. In the meantime, myself and the rest of the crew got ready to, with our small arms, ready to engage if it should have been trouble coming our way." They were coming from this path, right in the wood. Like I say, there was nobody else, none of our people in there, that part. They were coming, that's where the voices were coming from. I could hear them as well in the doorway. Anyway, they came on, and the chap up top, when they got fairly near, shouted, and there was a lot of talk, and it, obviously they were, it sounded to me like they were children, and they were. This was two little boys, about 10, 11, 12 years old, and they were absolutely frozen. Took them into the farmhouse, of course, and it turned, and these poor little souls, they weren't dressed for the weather was so cold, they'd walked through these woods. And I had one of my crew who could speak French, Benny Boos, and you, I believe, he spoke perfect French, and these boys could speak French. They were apparently two boys who'd been evacuated out into the countryside, either because it was easier to feed them there or whatever. And they told me this story after, of course, we'd thawed them out and given them something to eat. That earlier that day, was hiding in a wood from what they could see. They had seen Germans bring American prisoners into the field where the Germans had shot all these Americans. And they remained hidden in the woods and witnessed this. And now they'd made their way through the darkness, through the wood, and we were the first they stumbled on. I sent them, with one of my chaps, down to troop headquarters, sent Benny Boos with them, to explain this to the troop commander, that they had witnessed American prisoners being mown down by Germans. Whether any use ever came of the evidence that they could have given was ever made, I do not know, not to this day. I don't know. I assume the troop commander, we were in rather an isolated position up there, sent them back, and I don't know whether they were ever called upon, but they certainly witnessed the shooting of American prisoners. Soon after that, we were, I believe, oh, by the way, whilst we were there, time after time, we saw the German flying bombs coming past. I mean, we were up on the top of the crest, and these things, even though it was very bad misty weather, we caught sight of them. Other times we could hear them going through the mist overhead and whatnot without seeing them. But soon after those two boys came out of the wood, we were taken off the crest. And because apparently some German tanks had, we knew that where we were, German tanks had gone through the lines and were way behind us. Some German tanks were seen approaching somewhere in the rear, and we were taken down off the crest and made our way during that afternoon. And by late afternoon, we reached a little village, a Belgian village, where we were put into different billets. The troop, but it was dark by the time we were given a billet. There was no other troops about. We were going to act as a stopgap should these Germans come in that direction, these German tanks that had been seen. And troop commander took the cafe that was in the village, took that as his headquarters. I don't know where the rest went, but where I went was, for my sleeping, was a loft above a shop. There was no heating whatsoever. It was a loft, but no lighting, no heating. And that was assigned to me for my crew. And this would have been on the 23rd of December. And up in this loft, there was nothing. There was no, we had rations again, but not more like good that any rations that had got through to us. But anyway, came the next day, which was the 24th of December. How do I know that? My birthday, 24th December. The next day, we had to go and take up positions on a road. So we left. Oh, by the way, the people were living in the shop. I remember there was a gentleman, a lady, and a young lady in the shop. But once we'd gone in there, they kept out of that part of the shop, which gave us entrance to the loft. Didn't see much of them at all. The next day we had to go and take up positions near a crossroads to block, act as a block, if you like, in case the Germans were Again, they'd been seen coming in that direction with their tanks. And we spent the whole day frozen, just pulled up on the road. Nothing exciting happened. We didn't see anything of the Germans, didn't even hear anything of them either. And that evening, as it was getting dark again, the troop commander ordered us back to the same billets again. Which was rather unfortunate, because up in the loft, we had to urinate, etc. And nowhere we could dispose of anything. And we'd left it up there. And we were so afraid that the people who owned the place, in the shop, occupied it, had found that. So we were rather shamefaced when we entered back into that billet. But no, they had not been up in the loft. So up in the loft again it was for the night for us. But this was Christmas Eve, the 24th December. And those people, I remember the little entrance part where before we went up the loft. It was just a small room with a small table, very small. And we were sitting there when one of the people came from the back, and they were told by my French-speaking crew member that it was my birthday. And they came in and somehow sang happy birthday and all the rest of it. But we had nothing whatsoever to celebrate, because we rations were very low, what we had. Couldn't eat, nothing to give them. I asked if they would like a chicken for Christmas Day, thinking that I could go out and somehow find a chicken somewhere in the village. We went out. It was absolutely freezing in that late evening. Wandered around, but no sign of life, animal or human, anywhere. Obviously, it was so cold and people were inside and whatever. So there was nothing for the Christmas Day. We spent the Christmas Day there with nothing, if you like, very, very little to eat. And soon after that, the German positions were completely annihilated, I believe, and we were taken back to battery headquarters to have a late Christmas meal, late Christmas dinner. And we took up some other reserve positions in reserve here and there from time to time. And then we went to another part of Belgium where small parties were granted leave to go into Brussels. And my troop commander was well aware that myself and a couple of other guys had met people who we were interested in Nijmegen. And I got permission to take a lorry into Nijmegen, which was quite a considerable distance. It poured down, the whole journey it poured down, which was good, because we were afraid that trying to go back up the road, we might have been stopped by red caps somewhere and turned round, since new leave was being granted to places like Nijmegen, which was and remained for some considerable time a frontline town. And so movement for troops was very restricted. Only people eventually who had permission, and there was a curfew in the town and all the rest of it. So yes, this chucking it down with rain all night, really knocking it down, and so that suited us fine. We had a free run. We knew nobody would be standing out in the road unless they were mad, not to stop vehicles. So I made it to Nijmegen, and off went the lorry driver with another chap in the back to wherever it was their friends were in Nijmegen. And the next morning, the lorry came, picked us up again, and off we made our way back to where the troop was. Yes, and that episode in the Ardennes was the end of another period of tension, if you like, within the unit for us for a while. The next thing I can remember regarding being committed to action was when we were taking back up to Nijmegen. And we came to a standstill somewhere near the centre of the town, underneath a railway bridge, and there we waited for orders. It was miserable weather, still very cold. I don't know what time this was. I believe we were then told that eventually we would be committed to a big battle that was coming off, which was going to go drive deep into Germany, tackle the Siegfried Line and that type of thing. I did not get the opportunity whilst we were there, which was only for a very short while, to contact my young lady, unfortunately. And we'd only been there a day or so when the big battle commenced. I believe it was called, code name for the operation was Veritable. And we were told that we were not required in the initial attack, albeit we moved up closer to the people who were committed to go in first. And the next day, still raining, we moved onto the battlefield itself. A lot of open ground at this part. A lot of our tanks who had apparently gone into action the evening before were bogged down on the bellies in the mud. We managed to keep out of trouble. Apparently our infantry had gone forward and taken quite considerable casualties during that advance. We were told now that we would be going into action that evening under the use being made of what was called artificial moonlight. This was searchlights would be played on the clouds and enabling, supposed to enable our advancing forces to see what they were doing, and at the same time prevent the enemy from seeing what they were doing. I don't know how this was supposed to work out really, but it was teeming down with rain the whole of the time, very uncomfortable. Time to go forward came around, barrage went down from our artillery, the searchlights were switched on, and we moved forward. In no time at all, I found that I was rolling along slowly, of course, on my own, no sight or sign of anybody, of our own troops, anywhere at all. I decided to continue going forward, slowly. It was almost pitch black. I was running alongside what I could define just as a hedge. I continued rolling forward until I came to what looked like a large building. I came to a standstill outside this large building. It was obviously a barn-like building. By now, I suppose it would have been about 1 o'clock in the morning, and no sign whatsoever of any of our other troops. I could only see a few yards anyway. It was still teeming it down with rain. Our open turret made it very uncomfortable. We were soaking wet, cold. Nevertheless, we got through the most of the night, the next few hours, and I suppose it would be about perhaps 5:30 in the morning when we heard a voice calling. Sounded like a female voice calling. And as it approached, sure enough, it turned out to be two females. Elderly type women. German women, by the way. We were now in Germany. And they were calling out to what they thought were people. People in the barn. In the barn, it turned out, was the whole of the local Home Guard. The big door opened. They came trooping out to what they thought was a breakfast provided by these women, to find that we were there, instead parked outside. And when they'd all gathered outside, I don't know how many there were, possibly 8 or 10. They were elderly men and young boys, boys about 16 or 17, and men well in their 40s or 50s. And the two women were crying, telling me that they were only young boys, the youngsters, which they were. I pointed in the direction from which we had come and told them to make their way in that direction. These Germans, and they were in uniform, they all had uniform on, took off to and disappeared into the what was still darkness, blackness of the night, in the direction from which we had come. As it got light in the morning, we saw the first of our troops, carriers, a couple of infantry carriers arrived, and as they came to the position where we were, they turned right. They had also run alongside the hedge, which we'd been following the night before, during the night, and they turned right at the end of that hedge, away from this building, and there was one or two more buildings now becoming apparent as it got light, and again, there were only one or two buildings there. The carriers turned right away from the buildings, and then we saw a couple of our destroyers from my troop. They appeared, and we joined them and carried on along the road away from that particular area. We were up with the leading section because we soon ran into some small arms fire, and we came to a standstill near some scattered German houses along the side of the road, and the infantry carriers, together with some more infantry catching up, came along to deal with the bit of trouble up ahead. The trouble up ahead was a fork road with a bit of greenery in the fork itself, and so obviously some jerrys in there had given us a bit of trouble. The fork round to the left, as I found out later, led into the town of Cleve, the German town, which, and here I'm backtracking, should have been bombed in February by the Americans, who mistakenly bombed Nijmegen instead. However, that's by the way. Went into one of these houses on the side of the road to make a brew and to have a look round, see if there was anything worth having, and which was standard practice. This was still early in the morning, probably about 8 o'clock. We made a brew up, and shortly after that I came out onto the road in time to see coming towards us from the left across, coming from over the top of some trees and across the field, were German, a couple of German jet planes. I dashed up to the turret, meaning to engage them with the 50 caliber machine gun, but I then saw the bomb, that large bomb, detach itself from the leading jet and apparently heading straight for me. So I just ducked down inside the turret. The bomb passed over the top and burst on the other side of the road. There was more than one bomb from the aircraft. And unfortunately, the bombs caused casualties, especially amongst the infantry who were on foot alongside the side of the road. And I helped to take one of them into what had been set up as a forward aid station for the infantry. And I went in there, and there was a medical corps corporal, and I think he had one other chap with him, dealing with the casualties that were now being brought in from these bombs, as well as from the bit of trouble that had been up, caused up ahead by a few German soldiers. And anyway, whilst I was in there, one of the number twos from my troop, from another tank destroyer, who had opened fire on the jets, came in, and the middle was missing from one of his hands. I forget which one it was now. One of his hands had the middle missing. He was a Lance Sergeant, a Londoner. And, of course, I was talking with him. And another young infantry chap was brought in, an infantry corporal was brought in. The medical people that were there, this medical corporal and a chap who was helping him, were giving them mugs of tea and cigarettes. There was quite a few people wounded, stacked around in the room. And this other chap, called poor infantry corporal, came in. And I saw him handed a mug of tea and a cigarette. Unfortunately, the whole of his bottom jaw was missing. I went across and I took the mug out of his hand and took the cigarette out of his hand. He couldn't have done anything with either. And, yes, I mean, we from there, that was it, more or less. We moved on. The very next day, or day, a couple of days after, we found ourselves on the road to the next German town, which was Gok. I remember there was a long straight road leading towards Gok as we were advancing along it together with infantry. I remember one of the things I saw was a couple of officers going into the odd house that was built along this roadside, winkling out their own infantry at the point of a revolver and ordering them to get on and get up that road towards Gok. Obviously, some of the young troops, some of the young infantry men had enough of the battle and were taking cover unnecessarily at that particular time, and these officers were digging them out and sending them on their way to where they should be going. We reached the outskirts of Gok that evening. I don't know what day it was. And that evening, I believe it was that evening, a bombing raid, our own bombers were going across and carrying out a raid on a few miles away, possibly on the, I don't know, possibly on the, in somewhere around wherever, I don't know whether it was near Cologne or whatever, German industrial areas were a few miles away. But it was such a beautiful moonlight night, very little in the way of cloud up there, but you could see the contrails from the aircraft quite plainly from our bombers, and you could also see the German fighters in amongst them, and you could see the tracers coming away from the German fighters and from the bombers up there in the moonlight. And then I saw one of our bombers, couldn't see whether it was a bomber or what it was, but obviously it was, coming down towards us in flames. Flames were coming from it. And as it was coming down in the flames, we could see the parachutes leaving it. The crew were bailing out. And I think we saw the best part of five or six come out of that aircraft, and it was by then quite low to the ground. And as the last parachute came out, which was quite visible in the flames from the plane itself, so the aircraft hit the ground, and you could actually see in the explosion the parachute jump up in the air again. And that was it. I assume that was the pilot coming out last and was probably killed in the explosion of his own plane on the ground because his parachute jumped in the explosion. My M10, I sometimes refer to it as an M10, sometimes a tank destroyer, had some damage on it. I forget how it was caused now, no idea. And in the next day or two, I was ordered to take it back. Still, we were on the outskirts of Gok, to take it back to rear workshops, which were the other side of Nijmegen in Holland, which suited me fine. So I took off with my crew. I was driving, and went back and made my way across the border and into Holland and went to these rear workshops. I had a couple of my crew with me, the others had been left with the troop HQ, and made my way to the workshops.